what my sheet shows is the order and the time. So first we're going to hear from Attorney William O'Connor, who represents the Rock Koshkonong Lake District. That's 15 minutes. 10 minutes from Arthur Harrington, who represents the Rock River Koshkonong Association. 20 minutes from Cynthia Hirsch, Assistant Attorney General, who represents the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And 10 minutes by Mr. Charles Sweeney, representing the intervener, the Koshkonong Wetland Association. And Mr. O'Connor has 5 minutes in rebuttal. That gives each side 30 minutes, as is your due. All right? So everybody agrees to that. I see that on shaking of heads. We'll first hear from Attorney O'Connor.
If it pleases the court, my name is William O'Connor, and I'm honored to represent the Rock Koshkonong Lake District in this matter. Joining me at the council table is my colleague, Mary Beth Peranto, of our law firm of Wheeler, Van Sickle & Anderson. Also present in the courtroom is Brian Christensen, who is the chairman of the Rock Koshkonong Lake District, and other voting members of the district and its governing body. I intend, in the time I have allotted, to introduce our case and to focus chiefly on the navigable waters issues that are raised in the petition. Attorney Harrington will follow, and he will focus chiefly on the property-related issues raised in our petition. This case requires the court to declare the scope of two interests that DNR is charged to consider in a dam operating order under Section 3102 of the statutes, namely property and navigable waters. At this stage of the proceedings, the state acknowledges that the interpretation of Section 3102 raises questions of law to be reviewed by the court de novo. The case involves a DNR order governing the operation of the Indian Ford Dam below Lake Koshkonong, one of Wisconsin's largest lakes. The order was established, we believe, based on an incorrect interpretation of the statute. First, the agency improperly excluded evidence of the impact of its order on property in violation of the statutory directive to protect property. Second, the department exceeded its authority by considering private wetlands as though they were navigable waters, public rights in navigable waters. Finally, and I think this is important for the court to consider the context of this case, the agency failed to consider the effect of its order on the actual as opposed to the jurisdictional water levels of Lake Koshkonong. In fact, the record in this case clearly shows that the actual level of the water in Lake Koshkonong was historically maintained well above the level that was specified in then applicable orders. But shortly after this present version of the dam, which is a hydroelectric dam, was transferred to Rock County in the early 1960s, one of the dam's so-called wicket gates rusted shut. I don't want to go into the details of dam terminology or construction, but I do think it's important for the court to understand that this dam was constructed with two large tubes that direct water through the dam that previously actuated turbines that generated electricity. Those two large penstocks or tubes are opened and closed using gates. In the 1960s, one of those two gates rusted in the shut position. According to the ALJ, this was at some point in the 1960s. That gate remained frozen in the closed position until it was repaired in 2003. And as the ALJ's findings of fact make clear, that resulted in the water level of Lake Koshkonong being maintained at a level that was higher than would have been maintained if the order then in effect had been more precisely followed through appropriate gate operations of the dam by then the owner of the dam, Rock County. We believe that the court needs to fix the errors that were made in the department's construction of the statute. And in order to do that, we would urge the court to reverse the agency's order and to remand the case to the department to establish an amended operating order for the dam. That amended operating order should properly consider the scope of property that is protected under the statute, as this court determines that to be, and should consider the scope of navigable waters, the second protected interest that's contested in this case, again, as the court thinks that should be determined.
Now, let me just stop you.
Sure.
You say reverse the DNR order. This was an order by an administrative law judge, right, saying that the DNR order was okay, right?
Your Honor, the order that was established by the administrative law judge is the order, but under DNR rules and Chapter 227, that order became the agency's decision because the agency secretary declined to disavow the order.
That's why I wanted to make this clear. But in effect, we are reviewing the administrative law judge who made numerous factual findings, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And none of them are challenged. Is that right?
None of the factual findings are challenged. That's correct.
What is being challenged is only the conclusion of law that on the basis of these facts, and on the basis of excluding certain evidence relating to economic effects, but including evidence relating to private and public wetlands, right?
Private wetlands, Your Honor.
Yeah, you don't care about the public. But
we care about all wetlands.
Right, but that's not clearly distinguished in all of this, what's private and what's public, so looks as if it covered all wetlands.
That's correct, Your Honor.
If I understand this record and understand these findings. So you're saying that it has to be reversed because as a matter of law, it was improper to exclude the economic evidence, but you're not handling that. Co-counsel's handling that,
correct,
right?
But that is
so
the
we'll
position of the joint petitioners.
Right. And it was improper to consider wetlands that were private, right?
It was improper to consider wetlands that were private as if they were public rights in navigable water.
Well, as
we
if
acknowledge
they
that all property affected by a water level order is entitled to protection as property. What we dispute is the decision of the department to combine private wetlands with public waters and wetlands and treat all of them as the same thing. In other words, we would acknowledge the appropriateness of the Department of Natural Resources considering the impact of an order on all kinds of property that might be affected, commercial, residential, wetlands, and everything else. We believe the appropriate and really the only rational way for the department to do that is to evaluate the impact on property value because that provides a common yardstick. We don't believe it is possible for the Department of Natural Resources to inquire of each of the owners of the 4,400 or so parcels of land within the district boundary, which are the riparian parcels on Lake Koshkonong, and ask each owner how a particular water level would affect their personal preferences for their property. We think the appropriate way for that to be done is with a more analytical approach where you just consider the impact on the value of the property, which serves as a substitute for many different effects that could impact the property.
Mr. O'Connor, is there a difference between protecting property and enhancing the value of property? It seems to me that what you're arguing goes the other way, enhancing the value of the property.
Your Honor, I want to address this because you've asked it. Mr. Harrington will address it more specifically, but the testimony that was excluded was testimony in which the consultant was engaged to determine the impact on property that would result from a water level decline from what had previously prevailed and which was anticipated to result from leaving the water level order at the same elevation, but repairing the dam so compliance with that water level would be enhanced. In other words, the testimony went to the degree of injury that would be suffered by the property in economic terms, not an effort to enhance the value of the property by raising the water level.
So you think that the protecting the property means not having a decline in the value? It's the opposite of what Justice Crooks said.
That actually would not be my position, Madam Justice. We believe that when the legislature in 1915 established that standard of protect property, what they meant was to recognize that when you place a dam in a flowing stream, you transform a state of nature. And whether you're doing it to grind grist into flour, to float logs to mills, to saw them up, to generate electricity, or to create a recreational pool, the purpose of dams is to generate economic development. And we believe when the 1915 legislature used protect property, what they meant was a broader concept of protecting community-based economic values. And this is reflected in the early cases. The Rest Lake and Bear Lake case recognize that when a dam is put in, one of the consequences is that the property along the shore becomes more valuable. It becomes developed. That's a consequence. We believe that if a water level was proposed by DNR that would lower the level of the water body, that could diminish the value of property. We think DNR should consider that impact if they consider a water level order, whether it raises or lowers.
Now, Counselor, you said that that the DNR didn't consider the actual water level, and you think that that was error. And you were going to talk to us about the navigable waters issue, and your colleague was going to get into the protection of property. Would you describe for me how that lack of consideration of the actual water level bears on the issue of the navigable waters?
Your Honor, early decisions of this court decided even years before the enactment of this legislature, the court was faced with cases where impoundments had been created or water levels significantly modified by the placement of dams, and then water levels established at a higher level. In response to that, there was development along that shore, and in earlier cases of this court, including specifically Smith versus Yeomans, which is cited in our earlier briefs and I think in one of the amicus briefs here, the court held that the owners of that property have a cognizable property interest in maintaining that established water level after it has been established for a considerable period of time, and that lowering the water level after that, challenges those property interests. I don't think that this rises to the level of a property interest that it would necessarily be compensable under condemnation law, but it is certainly the level of an interest in property that we believe would be protected under this statute.
Is it because the people that would be most affected are riparians, and does it bear on what you think are the bundle of riparian rights?
In this particular case, I think it would primarily affect riparians. As you know from the hearing examiner's decision, there are locations on this water body where, with this lowered water level, riparian property owners are required to put in piers in order to moor boats and gain access to navigable water depths that are 300, 400, 500 feet long. And we think that the stake that those important stakeholders on the lake have is a protectable interest and that it should be considered by DNR when they set a water level order. In other contexts, where this case might be applied in the case of a hydroelectric facility, there could be significant changes up or down in a water level that would directly affect, you know, whatever goals might be prevailing at the time for the generation of clean energy or just the generation of revenue by utilities and related organizations that we think would also be, should be recognized by DNR and certainly should not be discarded and excluded categorically from consideration.
Mr. O'Connor, as I understand your argument, we're dealing with the language, the department, in the interest of public rights in navigable waters, may regulate and control the level and flow of water in all navigable waters, right? And I left out words, but that the words left out deal with Mr. Harrington's position, as I understand it,
yes,
not yours. So as I understand your position from your brief, and I may be wrong, but now's a good time to correct me, my understanding that it's your view to the DNR saying that the public rights in navigable waters include wetlands in and adjacent to navigable waters, that is, privately owned wetlands in and adjacent to navigable waters, just because they have a special relationship to navigable waters. You don't think that their relationship, this private wetlands relationship to navigable waters, falls within the language of 31021?
No, I don't, Your Honor. And
you agree with my statement of what your position is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So DNR has to avert looking at these private wetlands to determine what the public's interest is in navigable waters.
I would urge the Chief Justice to review the legislative history of this enactment, which is detailed in pages about 8 to 13 of the brief that we filed in the Court of Appeals. This legislation was in...
Somebody here has a lot of legislative history on, and there's several amicus briefs that is repeated in this, in the appendices, et cetera. And asking me to look at the Court of Appeals materials is not within the scope. Now, I happen to read the Court of Appeals stuff, but that's got a special problem. But all sides look to legislative history here.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You can read legislative history in a number of ways here.
We think the legislative history in this case is very persuasive, that in 1915, when this legislation was enacted, it was enacted by a committee, a prominent member of which, Paul Husting, was the very state senator who had litigated his right to go hunting on the Horicon Marsh and resulted in this court making a formal determination on the boundaries of navigable waters at the ordinary high water mark, and as chairman of the same committee, advocated for related legislation that essentially put a bounty on wetlands and led the University of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Blue Book in 1915 to develop programs to specifically aimed at the drainage of wetlands. I don't believe that in the context of that history, it's reasonable to assume what the legislature intended was to cover navigable waters as they were defined in as they were public rights in navigable waters, as they were recognized in the Just case 60 years later. And there's an important point on that, Your Honor, that I would like to make, if I may, which is that in the Just case, there was not a question about whether DNR or the county had the right to include adjacent wetlands within navigable waters.
It was a zoning case.
The question was, can the legislature enact a law that compels counties to regulate those nearshore areas? There is no corresponding provision here.
Counsel, one of the problems in this case on legislative history is, to coin a phrase, there's been a lot of water under the dam since this statute was enacted. When it didn't deal with a DNR, it dealt with the Railroad Commission, if I've got to remember my facts,
right.
Dealt with the Department of Health or whatever its name was at that time. And so even your old cases have difficulty. They're not exactly on point, and they're dealing with a history that has evolved over the years. So I have the last word on this, and you've got a red light.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Harrington, I
May
hope
it
we
please
didn't
the court.
Steal your thunder.
Okay. This is a case about an administrative agency that refused to consider property interests of landowners despite the legislature's clear direction to do so. It's a very important case, not only to the hundreds of property owners on and in the vicinity of Lake Koshkonong, but the tens of thousands of landowners on the more than 2,000 impounded lakes in Wisconsin.
What's an impounded lake? Just tell me. Because I live on Monona. Is that impounded?
An impounded lake is really one that is the level is established by a dam. You know.
Okay.
So that's what we're talking. There are a lot of impounded lakes that are controlled by the dam. And this case is going to be watched closely, the precedential impact for that reason. And I also want to clarify, because the justices have asked some questions about what is the appellant's position in this case on economic property.
Mm-hmm.
It is to prevent impact to property values from declining water levels. It was very important at the outset to appreciate my co-counsel's discussion of what happened here over the decades in terms of elevated property water level. And our position is the DNR's water order should be changed to conform to the actual water levels that existed for the past decades. It's in the context of this unique fact situation that the economic testimony is directly relevant to protect property. And in fact, I have the privilege of preparing the economic testimony that was excluded, and it's very carefully crafted to consider the impact of a new order that brings the water level down from what it had existed for decades, and the impact that would have on declining economic values for not only property owners, but for businesses that were directly related to water levels.
Well, Counselor, couldn't the property owners around the lake have the same problem if they raised the water level and then changed the high water mark so that the lake could be maintained at a higher level? You could have properties in Wisconsin that are clearly built in the floodplain, and if you raise the water level much and you have a storm, you could have the lake in your front door.
You're right, Your Honor, and I think what we're talking about here is a balancing test. We are not standing here to tell you that the result has to be considered economic value and the level should be directed as we argued it should be. This case is about an agency making the decision excluding a portion of evidence that is important in the balancing that is in that statute. It is a delicate balance. It is property interests in navigable waters. It's protect property, and it can be dealing with both issues, Your Honor, that you addressed, but to exclude a line of testimony and to not consider it, we believe, is a error of law and should be remanded for that reason.
It's your
position. Can you summarize the testimony that you offered?
Summarize it, Your Honor?
Sure.
Sure. We had two expert witnesses, Mr. Cation, who is an economist, and his testimony was premised on the modeling testimony in this case, as reflected in the findings of fact, that for decades, this water level at Lake Koshkonong was higher than the level order that the department wanted to impose. On that assumption, he did an economic analysis, Your Honor, of how property would decline in value over time if that water level were going down to a level that was significantly less than existed for decades. That was the economic testimony of the economist. And we also had a urban planning expert, John Stockham, using the same assumption. And he talked about the impacts of declining
water levels from what existed on property values in the area and business income that were related to water levels and the impact of those declining values on government revenues. That was summarizing, but I think it's critical, Your Honors, that testimony had a necessary predicate, in this case, of a declining water level on the order that DNR imposed versus what occurred there for decades because of the inoperable gates. So it's in that context that you need to struggle with what does protect property mean, and was the testimony, which was designed to show the adverse impact on declining values and business incomes from what had existed over decades, is that relevant to protect property?
I don't know if that's it. I mean, you know, you steeped in this case, but you said, is it relevant to protect property? I understand your argument to be that the words protect property requires the consideration of the economic impact, not whether it's relevant. I understand also that some of the earlier cases that have been referred to use, I think, of the Chippewa-Flambeau case that talked about they might consider the impact. So in my mind, it's whether or not they may consider it, if they consider it relevant, or they are required to consider it. And it seems to me that you are arguing, the essence of your argument is protect property requires the consideration of the economic impact. Do I have that right?
You have it right, and also in the context of this case, Your Honor, the association introduced evidence on that issue, and it was discarded as saying it wasn't relevant. So I believe our position is it certainly is required for DNR to look at it in the abstract, but certainly when parties of interest introduce evidence in a water rights case, clearly it is a requirement that must be analyzed in connection with the balancing test.
Well, wasn't there also evidence that there's been rising property values on this lake all through these years, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's right.
And so the evidence you were wanted to introduce and was required that it be considered is hypothetical as to what might happen with lower water levels. Isn't that the point of
that's an expert opinion. I think that's an accurate summary of the intent of the testimony, but I also would like to just refer to the point that the testimony was directed to protecting property values from what is anticipated to be a decline as a result of the lower water level.
May I ask, could the ALJ have issued the same order after considering all of the evidence that you say was excluded?
In the abstract?
Yeah.
If this were remanded and that evidence were introduced, I would say it would not be an error as a matter of law for him to come to a contrary conclusion. Our position here, Your Honor, is to not even consider it is an error, and this court should not be predicting what a hearing examiner would decide on a remand if that evidence went in. It's a balancing test, and I agree with Your Honor that he could come back and make the same decision, but I think it is incumbent on this court, and I'm sure you're struggling with this, given the fact that we're not here, you know, decrying any findings of fact. This is not harmless error. This has to go back, because to say it's harmless error, you would have to conclude that a hearing examiner could not find in the favor of the petitioners here had they considered that evidence. And I don't think this case rises anything close to that standard. And it would be anything, and if that were the decision of this court, I think we're dealing with a very important precedential case for the reasons I mentioned. And what message does that send to the authority of the agency in the future on whether they will consider or not consider economic testimony on a water level case?
Counselor, now this order of the ALJ that we're reviewing has become the DNR's order because they didn't contest it. So if there's a remand for consideration of this information, doesn't it go all the way back to the DNR? It just doesn't go to the ALJ.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. I agree with you. It goes to the department for
They have to consider.
They have to make the decision, and the parties, if they disagree with it, and we have a lot of parties here with a lot of viewpoints. It's our view they have the right to request a contested case on that matter.
Okay. Just start again.
Excuse me?
Start again. And what's the water level going to be in this interim period? How long
will
this take, 6 or 7 years?
That is a superb question because I have struggled with that. I've struggled with this, Your Honor, in terms of our position on this case. Our position on this case is this order should not have been granted, and we are now living under a water level that is lower than it had been for decades, now for almost another decade. And I think the court should consider on a remand that the water levels that existed since 2005 when we had this hearing should not be considered in terms of the environmental impacts of the request as well as the property value question. We should be looking, and the remand we would request is you look at the water levels that existed for decades and you compare the environmental impacts and the property value economic testimony against those water levels, and you do not take into consideration the water levels that existed now for the last 8 years because of the unique posture of this case. This case, I've lived with it for 12 years, Your Honor, and we're here, and it's an excellent question. I think you need to struggle with that in terms of, if you agree with our position, what the remand is going to be, and we think it's important to have some direction on this remand for the reasons we're stating.
Well, I didn't see that in your briefs. I might have missed it, but I didn't see it. The page 32 is, you respectfully ask the court to reverse the decision to deny the district's proposal and remand the matter of the agency with directions consistent with the court's determination as to the geographical scope of public rights in navigable waters. That's the issue O'Connor talked about, Attorney O'Connor, and the extent of property interests. So you don't say about going back to what year will we go back to, 1915? No.
No. I would say that the baseline we're talking about and the economic testimony was based upon was what was the level that occurred during the time those gates were inoperable.
Okay.
That's the point. And nothing clarifies the mind, Your Honor, like preparing for an argument in terms of our thoughts on mandate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now lost my sheets. Here it is. We're now going to hear from Cynthia Hirsch, Assistant Attorney General representing the DNR. You got 20 minutes, Ms. Hirsch.
Thank you. May it please the court, I represent the Department of Natural Resources on this case. Since 1972, this court in the Just case has recognized, and I'm quoting, that land adjacent to navigable waters exists in a special relationship to the state. More than 12 miles of Lake Koshkonong's 27 miles of shoreland is undeveloped wetland. Chapter 31 clearly invokes the public trust to direct the department to consider the impact of lake levels on the quality of the navigable lake. You can't protect the navigable lake without protecting the waters, in this case the wetlands, that flow into the lake. We disagree with petitioners in this respect. What this case is about is DNR using its authority under Chapter 31 to protect the navigable lake, Lake Koshkonong, by looking at the impact of their activity, setting water levels, on wetlands that flow into the lake. The quality of the wetlands are important because they impact the navigable Lake Koshkonong.
I understand your argument, and when I read your briefs, it seemed to me that you weren't trying to regulate the wetlands so much as determine what effects they had on Lake Koshkonong, which you were trying to regulate. But with the higher water levels that had been in place before the dam was repaired to be able to comply with a DNR order, the wetlands were at some level being maintained then too, weren't they? And was there testimony that there was an adverse effect on Lake Koshkonong because of the effect on the water levels back then?
Actually,
in the wetlands.
Thank you. Yes, actually, you've stated our position correctly, and the record does show that the quality of the wetlands and the quality of the lake had been degraded. That is in the findings of facts that the ALJ found. And I'd also like to remind this court that the 1991 order that sets the water levels that the petitioners dispute was an agreed-upon order. It was developed by working with all the constituents on the lake by DNR as a result of the repairs to the dam that then enabled them to implement that agreed-upon order. And that's the order that we're addressing here today. Again, the findings of fact show that there had been degradation to the wetlands and the lake, and DNR balanced all factors. There are 120, I believe, findings of fact that are undisputed in this case. The petitioner has not challenged those. DNR considered and balanced all of the factors necessary to protect the resource, as well as the use of the waters of the state.
You say you didn't balance the economic interests.
We would submit, Your Honor, that it looked at protection of fish and fowl, habitual natural beauty, recreation, navigation, and the use of the lake by riparian owners. And in some sense, economic interests are subsumed in looking at riparian owners. There is nothing in Chapter 31 or any case that requires the petitioners, that requires the department to monetize the real estate value of the shoreland property while protecting the use and quality of the resource. What DNR excluded from the hearing, what the ALJ excluded from the hearing, was evidence of property values and business income. There is no case that has been cited in this case that obligates DNR to take a look at or monetize property values. And considering the impact of regulating water levels on the monetary value of property would have no end. That's the problem here. How does DNR speculate going forward that in the future, how will the lake levels impact property values for some and others? How does DNR compare? Where does this end over a period of time? Obviously, lake levels changing, and DNR does have the authority to change lake levels, will probably, maybe, enhance some properties and not others. How does DNR, looking ahead, speculate about the change in property values, compare those changes, and make decisions about who will benefit and who won't, and how then does DNR balance those interests? Do we really want DNR to be the arbiter of property values?
What did the ALJ say as justification for excluding that evidence? What was the basis for his exclusion?
The basis, I believe, for his excluding was that it was irrelevant to the duty that DNR had consistent with Chapter 31.
Thank you.
As I can see it, there are just a lot of different interests, right?
Right.
There's an interest in whether people should have a 50-foot pier or a 300-foot pier. That's a big cost difference to the particular pier owner. There's a difference of what types of vegetation will develop in the lake or an adjacent waters at one level or another level. What kind of, use the broad term, animals, fish, or plant life will develop in the lake, depending on the lake level, right? Because sun can come in and does things with the lake. So this whole thing is a balancing. DNR has to balance a heck of a lot of different interests, right? Even riparian owners have different interests for what you just said.
Right.
Live on one side of the lake, it's one issue. And you live on the other side of the lake, it's another one. So, and that's what the DNR does. So what's the matter with them adding a little money into this balancing? You know, money doesn't hurt. Economic interests don't hurt. I mean, this is a basic concept.
I think that DNR is obligated under the public trust and under the statutes to look at use and to look at the impact on the resource as it is used, which means recreation, it means enjoying the natural beauty, and it means fishing, it means the quality of the lake. To then take the leap that DNR has to become the arbiter of real estate values is quite another thing. First, I don't know how DNR can do that. I don't know how they could consider in a speculative way the value of real estate. I also would argue, Your Honor, that where DNR is asked to explicitly look at economic impact, the law specifically states that, such as the air pollution laws. Further, I would argue that when DNR is obligated to do an environmental assessment, an EA, it does look at economic impact within the limited scope of an EA, which is informative and not a decision driver.
But they do EISs, too, on a very large scale. When you're looking at power plant siting, and they certainly look at a lot of economic interests and have some mechanism for considering what weight to give them.
There are times when DNR is explicitly directed to look at the economic interest, but in this statute, they are not.
But my response to you was more in response to saying, you're saying you didn't know how they do it, and my response was, well, they do it a lot of other times, so they must have a mechanism. Statutory interpretation, I think, is what we're here about today, and the question is whether they're required to do it, whether they may do it, or whether they can just forget about it. I mean, that's where we are, right?
I agree.
Yeah. Thank you.
I would like to remind the court that DNR did do a thorough investigation, including an environmental assessment. They're entitled to deference. After an extensive contested case hearing, the ALJ found that DNR's decision was necessary to protect the public rights and reasonably balances and accommodates public and private rights. The Circuit Court agreed, and the Court of Appeals affirmed, and we are asking this court to do the same. I will now relinquish the podium to my colleague, Mr. Sweeney, who will address the court on behalf of the interveners, unless you have a question, Justice Prosser.
One of opposing counsel talked about de novo review, agreeing upon de novo review. Maybe I misunderstood that.
We agree that de novo review is appropriate if the issue is authority under the law and interpretation of the law. And in fact, the Court of Appeals did apply de novo review and affirmed the ALJ's decision. We're comfortable with that. We disagree that when it comes to interpretation of their own statutes and rules, that DNR is not entitled to some deference. And we believe that in this case, when they're interpreting, in suggesting what Justice Rogensack just asked me, what it means to protect property, they are due deference. In this case, DNR has protected property by looking at the physical impacts and the physical injuries afforded property, and that's the way DNR has always interpreted that portion of the statute. We would argue that they're entitled to deference on that issue.
Court of Appeals avoided that tough issue, really, of what the deference is. Court of Appeals avoided that issue and said, whatever the deference is, this is a reasonable interpretation and we're going to adopt it. So if it's great weight, you win, DNR wins. If it's due deference, it wins. And if it's de novo, you win. So we're not going to have a long opinion on no. What this is.
We agree. We are very comfortable.
You agree. You agree with me, or you agree with the Court of Appeals?
I don't want to concede what standard was appropriate, but for purposes of this case before you, we are comfortable with the fact that the Court of Appeals applied de novo and found the decision to be solid and will not take issue with that.
Thank you, counsel. Charles Sweeney, representing the intervener respondent, Lake Koshkonong Wetland Association, Inc.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Charles Sweeney, and I represent the Lake Koshkonong Wetland Association, also Thibault Hunting Club, another one of the interveners in this case. I come before you today not only as an attorney for the Lake Koshkonong Wetland Association of Thibault Hunting Club, I'm also president of Thibault Hunting Club, which has 2 miles of shoreline on Lake Koshkonong and is one of the large marshes that is talked about in a lot of the briefs. I was married on the edge of the marsh in a camo sport coat, and my wife had a camouflage wedding gown as the sun was setting over the lake and the moon was coming up over the marsh. So,
duck hunting season.
And I did shoot a limited ducks before I got married, or I may not have got married. But we have our golden anniversary this weekend because we have a floating anniversary. My position, it's on the opening day of duck season. Her position is it's September 29th. Which is the same, it happens to be the same day, so I guess it's our golden anniversary.
Well, even if you invite us, we're not coming.
Thank you. I want to address several points, but before we go there, I want to emphasize one particular point that I find somewhat remarkable by the petitioners. If you look at what this case is about a request to raise, and I highlight that. This is not about keeping the status quo. They are trying to raise the water level 8 inches, which will destroy the marsh that I hunt at and hunt with my grandchildren, my son, and numerous other family members. This is a place that I cherish, and we watch the birds come up in the morning. We watch the sunset. They are taking away a lot of rights here that DNR was in the process of evaluating numerous rights, including boating rights, hunting rights, bird watching rights, a lot of different rights here. But if you look at it, what they want to do during the summer is they want to raise the water level 7 to 8 inches. In 1991, we had a lawsuit that was filed in Jefferson County against the DNR. Thibault Hunting Club, Shearer Hunting Club, and several other hunting clubs were involved in that. I was an expert witness in that particular case. In that situation, this came out, and it was a compromise. In the 1991 order, is a compromise. The levels on the lake were raised. The idea was that we would never have to come back to the court system again in order to deal with high water levels that were affecting our property. Instead, we're back at the court starting in 2005, and it's 2012 today, and we believe that there's been enough litigation and enough money spent in this particular case. It rest assured, this is about petitioners' effort to raise the water level, not the status quo. Mother Nature has a lot more control over this body of water. Lake Koshkonong gets water bodies from 8 different sources of watersheds. You know, the economy is down, but they still are building some houses. We still have parking lots. We still have water that drains from weather into the Rock River, into the Crawfish River, into Lake Koshkonong. This area is controlled by runoff and coming into this lake. This is a huge reservoir for a lot of water coming down into the lake. This is not a huge change. This is what DNR is doing is they're continuing the 1991 order, yet because of the winter drawdown and their balancing of a number of rights, including fishing, they have concluded that they should raise the winter water level, draw it down 6 inches, and come up with it. And that's what we're talking about today, and so we have the status quo. This is not about lowering the water level. Just because Mother Nature rains a lot, this year we have a drought. Are we going to say that we're not going to have any water because we didn't get a lot of rain? Every water body around is low because of the drought.
Councilor, do you agree that this 1991 order wasn't actually effective in regard to how it affected the actual water level until about 2003?
There's a series of issues with what we call the wicket gates. Okay. The gates that were allowing the water, there's 2 sets of gates there. One are gates that are raised up and down, more like a stop log type of gate, and those have always been operating. Sometimes they were not operated effectively by Rock County, but they were operable in most situations, even though it was difficult to raise them at times. The wicket gates, the testimony is fairly clear that they were in disrepair. At one point, one of them was left open, so it was not allowing you to back up the water. Other times they were closed. There was a lot of testimony back and forth, but it is not clear from the record in front of us exactly how much effect that would have on the particular water levels. But it is true they were in disrepair, and what the Lake District did is they got those wicket gates back in operation, which is assisting. But there's also wide spots in the Rock River by the railroad bridge, which is about halfway down the river. In Newville, there's a rock formation that comes up that minimizes the amount of water that can go through the particular river. So there is a lot of natural sources besides the Indian Ford Dam, which controls the water levels in the lake. And that was all part of the record that was made in the 120 facts.
My question was really focused on trying to get a understanding factually of whether the current water level was the current water level beginning in 1991 when the order was entered, or whether the current water level began around 2003. Not so much on why, just the water level.
I don't think it's that easy because of all the extrinsic factors that are there. I think it's clear that you have better control of the water levels when the wicket gates are operating than you do when they don't operate. I would say that's true. But there's a lot of factors here. It depends on the amount of rain. Was the dam operator operating appropriately? All those kind of things.
Can I ask that question slightly differently? Is the water level the same, higher, or lower now than it was in 1991?
In the 1991 order is the order that's there now. And what DNR said is we're not going to change.
Not the order, the lake, the body of water. Is it higher, lower, or the same as the body of water was in 1991?
Well, I guess it depends on what day in 1991, but because of the drought this summer, generally it's been lower than it was in 1991 because we've had a drought condition which affects the water more than the dam and more than anything that we can control. If you have a lot of rain in Horicon, where a lot of the water comes from, or one of the other watersheds, the water goes up fairly quickly.
I understand that, but I'm just trying to figure out, is it higher, lower, or the same after the dam was put in?
The dam's always been there. It's just they fixed two wicket gates. They just fixed two of the wicket gates, and that's not the only control that we have here. That's what's somewhat frustrating.
I understand that.
And it's frustrating when they keep saying we're asking to lower the water level. We're asking the status quo. Everybody has gotten along with the status quo. Maybe, that's what people bought.
Maybe I missed something. I thought the dam was broken for some time. Yes?
Depends on how you define dam. You have the wicket gates, which generated electric power,
right,
became in disrepair. And that's only two of the gates of the other, I don't know if there's five or six, but there's several other gates where water goes through the dam.
Okay. So it wasn't fully functioning for some time. Part of it was open,
correct,
right? Is the water the same, higher, or lower after the dam was fixed?
When the dam is fixed, you have more control over the water. Is maybe one better way to understand. But generally speaking, because of the amount of watershed coming to the lake, it's very seldom that you can get to the lower water levels. You're more often above the target levels of the dam orders.
Okay, maybe it's just not as simple as I'm trying to make it.
It really isn't because of the large amount. You had all these watersheds coming into.
I understand that, but you've always had those. Watersheds aren't natural things that occur. Rain occurs. You have different seasons that might impact water levels, and that varies from year to year. I fully understand that. But what I'm trying to figure out is the dam the thing that changed the water level here?
The dam has according to their own experts, Rob Montgomery, has minimal effect depending in areas of high flow. The dam does have some control on if letting water out faster by cubic feet per second.
What you're saying then today is the DNR's activity regarding the dam has nothing to do with water level.
No, it has everything to do with the water level because you have target levels of minimum and maximum. What I'm saying is because of a large rainfall, you can get to that, but then it takes a while by the time you let water out of the lake. You have certain target levels since 1991 have been agreed upon. DNR went through and they balanced a bunch of different rights, including boaters, including riparian owners, and took a bunch of testimony. And they came to the conclusion that we should leave the 1991 order the way it is, except for the winter drawdown and changing the winter drawdown.
So the question that you think the court should be asking you is not whether the water level is the same now as in 1991, or that the water level is the same on August 5 as it is on August 31st. But the question that I hear you answering is the DNR statement of what the targeted water levels should be, the the same now as they were in 1991, and you, I keep hearing...
My answer is yes to that, Your Honor.
That's right. And I keep hearing you say, yup, except...
Except for the winter drawdown.
Winter drawdown, they have higher levels in the winter. Or was it lower? I can't remember. But the order that is under review here says some of the same, we are not raising.
We are not raising the water level. That's correct.
Not raising the water level. And you're saying that's the same targeted water level as 91.
Correct.
And then the order that we're reviewing here says, but as to the winter water level, we're changing it a bit. And I don't hear anyone arguing really about that. What they want is higher water in the summer.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And you're saying, hey, same as 91 target. The DNR cannot always meet its target, can it?
Because of Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Correct.
So if you have a heavy rain, and I don't know if last night's was heavy enough to make a dent in the water level, but if you have a heavier rain, there'll be a higher water level, which may or may not be controlled or controllable by the dam.
That's correct. But in this proceeding, where we went through 10 days of testimony, we had evidence that came in from both sides. And DNR then balanced all that evidence, looking at all the different rights that it's got the ability to do, and then they made the decision not to raise.
I know, but the objection is not what they considered. The objection is that the DNR excluded economic value.
Their economic impacts, yes, Your Honor.
And it would seem to me that your hunting club, which owns the owns land,
correct,
would have increased or decreased value of the land depending on the level of the water. Because you said to me in the court that if they raised it, that it would destroy what your club can do on the land. So that would decrease your value. Maybe not. Maybe you could sell it for more.
No, we think that, you know, They talk about the impacts that we're talking about, but what they're talking about is trying to quantify this with simply property values. And the DNR looked at that regarding the riparian rights issues of various parties, and they said, you know, some people have to put a pier out further, so they did look at a portion of that. What we're saying is the DNR shouldn't have to look at the secondary economic impacts, because where does it stop? What about the gas station in Milton? What about the restaurant in Edgerton? While it might affect the buckhorn rate on the property, there's no ending point to quantify and put that into perspective. We look at DNR to look at that, but then if you're going to quantify that, how do you quantify when your son and your grandson and your daughter shoot their first duck or catch their first fish? Are we going to have to try to quantify and put a monetary value on that in order to balance? That's the struggle. And that's why we think protect property is really about the riparian properties that are surrounding the lake, and that's really what the intent of the legislature. Things have changed since 1915 when people filled wetlands in and dammed up water for hydroelectrical power, and now DNR is in charge as the public trust doctrine. They have to balance the fishing rights, the boating rights, the hunting rights, the riparian rights. They have a difficult job, and I believe in this case they did an excellent job of balancing all those factors to come up with the right decision at the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Sweeney, I understood
Justice Prosser,
your opening remarks to be that Mr. O'Connor and Mr. Harrington want to destroy the marsh that you hunt on.
My view of it as a member of the marsh that I hunt on, we've had a drought this year, and that's helped the marsh. Marshes have to go up and down with fluctuations of water levels in order to be healthy marshes. Raising the lake will never allow that marsh. It'll become a eutrophic marsh, and it's headed in that direction until this year when we finally had a drought that allowed some of the vegetation to revegetate. You need that in some of the wetlands surrounding the lake to be effective wetlands and to be looked at. So personally, yeah, I truly believe that would happen, and that's a place that I cherish and want to have my grandkids and great-grandkids and everyone else cherish that land that I've grown up on my entire life.
Have you always been able to hunt on that marsh?
Except for 1967 when we had to go to Horicon because we had a drought. Every other year since I was 3 years old, I've hunted on that land.
So But I understand that opposing counsel, you say, want to raise the level in that marsh 7 or 8 inches.
Because it's connected, it's hydraulically connected to the lake, correct?
But and if that's related to what it was before, you hunted on the land before, on the marsh before.
Yeah, and if they raise it, what it does is it becomes flooded and becomes more of an open water area rather than a marsh.
But you hunted there. Because correct. You said you hunted there every year except 1967.
Correct. When there was a drought.
Well, what was the water level before?
The water levels on the marsh have fluctuated up and down on this lake. There's no question. You can hunt. You hunt differently in open water versus when you hunt going through cattails and skiing through cattails and that sort of thing. It's a different type of hunting. We're concerned that the quality of the marshland by a raising of the level, and it's in the record, a number of the marshes, including Carcajou, which is a forested wetland, wooded wetland, one of the last available, would be destroyed, and that's all part of the record and part of the testimony.
But I hear what you say is that as to the DNR, which doesn't have control over everything, including drought, that the DNR level in 1991 was the same as the DNR level now.
That's correct.
But the actual level can be much higher or much lower, depending on the state of nature.
That's correct.
So that you could or couldn't hunt or fish in any particular year is because the DNR couldn't control at the level.
No one could control those levels. And Justice Prosser, where I think he's going with that is, yeah, we're going to be able to do it. It's just taking a resource into the detriment. And that's part of the balancing that DNR did in looking at the 120 different findings of facts and conclusions of law. And what we're trying to do is balance that versus the boating area. And the boating would generate, if you raise it, you generate approximately 44 acres more of surface area. But you also get a lot more silt and sediment and phosphorus and nitrogen from the agricultural community as it silts in because you have a lot of lowland surrounding here. There's testimony from the agricultural area that they would be damaged as well by the raising of the 7 inches.
Yes, Professor?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. O'Connor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to address a few points in rebuttal. The department opens with a continuing discussion of the Just case. And, you know, I'm a long-term supporter of shoreland zoning. I'm a true believer in Just versus Marinette County. But that case is inapposite to the issues before the court. That case decided, this court decided, that it was not unconstitutional for Marinette County, pursuant to statute, to regulate wetland areas within 1,000 feet of a lake or 300 feet of a stream, dimensions that were established by statute.
Mr. O'Connor, I think you did a good job of explaining that position in your brief. I want to come back to a question that was posed to you during your initial presentation. That was by the Chief Justice when she asked something along the lines of, does your position mean that the DNR has to avert its eyes when it comes to consideration of the quality of the lake water as it goes through the wetlands when it considers what everyone seems to agree to be its proper area of observation, which is the quality of the water in the lake? And that got us into a discussion of statutory history, but I guess I would like to know the answer to that question. Because it seems to me, and that was what your opposing counsel from the DNR led her presentation off with, by saying something along the lines of, look, this is not an exercise of regulation. You have to look at the impact on the resource here being the lake, and that was the sole purpose for the DNR examining the water quality in the wetland, because as I understand it, if the water level is raised according to the evidence that was accepted, the fish will be less likely to spawn, there will be more sediment stirred up, the water quality in the wetland will diminish, which will ultimately lead to a diminishment of the quality of the water in the lake.
Your Honor, I would just call your attention to the factual record developed by the administrative law judge, which did recognize that the Lake Koshkonong is an impaired water body under federal law.
Yeah.
and that the water quality of the lake, which is significantly impaired, will not be redeemed by either of the water level orders that are in play in this case, neither the DNR's order or the one preferred.
I want
by
to get
the
to this
district.
Idea of the public trust doctrine. Much is made in the briefs about this is an unwarranted, unjustified expansion of public trust doctrine. And I'm asking you, well, I'm asking you, first of all, how? Because if the DNR is saying, we're not interested in regulating privately owned wetlands, we're not interested in doing that, we only considered the water quality there as it impacted the quality of the water in the lake. What is the practical effect? All I want to, right now, I just want to get at, what is the practical effect of your client's position that DNR may not, in the words of that was used in the question posed to you, must avert its eyes towards the water quality in the wetlands?
Your Honor, we believe that the court can look at the water quality in the wetlands, but the record in the case shows that the water quality will not be significantly affected by either of the orders in this case. And the overwhelming volume of the testimony in the many days of the contested case hearing did not focus on that topic. It focused on the independent benefits to the wetlands.
I want to get to
it
this
was
second.
Not based on how the wetlands might be affected by the water level of the lake and how that in turn might affect the water quality of the lake.
I want to get to this idea, though, of the unwarranted expansion of the public trust stop. I'm trying to figure out how. If they're saying we're not regulating it, we're not coming in with orders, we're not coming in with standards and requirements in privately owned wetlands, we only consider the water quality of the wetlands as it impacted the water quality of the lake. That's what I'm asking.
Your Honor, I think the best answer that I can give you is that we believe that the statute requires DNR to focus on the navigable waters themselves. That's what the public interest is. That's the real estate over which the public has an ownership interest, a property interest, and the state has a trust responsibility. And we believe that the state's focus on wetlands that are privately owned and above the ordinary high watermark undertook to extend the concern for public waters into an unmeasured area that is remote from public waters. We don't think they would have any more authority to do that than they would be to consider the impacts on, as Mr. Sweeney says, the gas station in Milton, that it's remote from the subject of the statutory directive to evaluate public rights and navigable water. Well,
that is going to have an impact that is not included in the gas station in Milton or Ashland or wherever.
Your Honor, the ALJ's order says what it says. Certainly that was not an issue that was emphasized during the department's testimony, which did not focus in any way on that subject of the impact of the order on the wetlands, on the water quality of the lake. I want to... I think there is a reference of that kind, Your Honor, but it does not change the fact that the hearing examiner recognized that the water quality of the lake is impaired and that it's the water quality would not be materially affected by either of the water of the orders that were under consideration.
You say that's a finding of the hearing examiner, that the water quality of the lake would not be affected regardless of the water level?
There is a finding to that effect, Your Honor. I don't have the entire appendix with me, and maybe my co-counsel can fish out that order. And if I may, I'd like to just address a couple of more points in rebuttal, if I am permitted to, Madam Chief Justice.
Just a very short time.
Okay.
Your red light has been on for some time, so
I understand
make it
that, Your Honor.
Short.
Thank you for your courtesy. With respect to the question of there is no end to the economic evaluation What we are not requiring DNR to monetize every impact of a water level order. We recognize that DNR has broad authority in this area and broad discretion to determine how they undertake this task. We believe that they would have the authority to establish the limits of economic investigation just in the same way they need to impose some limit on how far they go in looking at the environmental or public trust interests.
Yes, but
and we would defer to their authority to do that.
The excluded testimony of the expert witnesses included testimony regarding the lake-related commercial property. Those commercial enterprises that are not right on the lake, a restaurant or a gas station, and it's your position or your co-counsel's position that they are required, as I understand it, to consider that.
They are required to consider competent, relevant evidence that is presented to them in a contested case hearing, but I believe that they have the discretion to determine the extent of an investigation that they will undertake on their own in order to fulfill the protect property requirement.
If I were a trier of fact, and I've never been an administrative law judge in this kind of a context, but I might say, well, you know, how it affects the restaurant down the street doesn't really come within, as I see it, the constitutional provisions or the statutory provisions, so it might not be relevant, and I might exclude it. I mean, it seems not far-fetched.
I think the focus that we would put on that question is the parties agree that the court has the authority, de novo, to determine, to interpret the statute. And so the property interests that are subject to protection, we believe, is the purview of the court. It's the responsibility of the court. And the department's view that they have the authority to determine what property will be protected, we think goes beyond the powers of an administrative agency. The agency has no special expertise in the in interpreting a phrase like protect property in the protect property standard under 3102. We think it's the responsibility of the court to establish what the property is that's entitled to protection. I want to briefly say one more thing, if I can, on the whole question of the water level compliance. Madam Chief Justice, the Rock River is a very big basin. When it rains, a lot of water comes down the system. And a significant part of the time, when water levels are high, in the high water season, in the spring and perhaps early summer, the dam is overflowed by water and it does not control the high end of the water level. But the administrative law judge specifically found that with the wicket gates restored, that the dam can control the low-end water level 81% of the time during the summer season. And there are a series of findings by the administrative law judge that go to the degree to which the now-repaired dam will be able to maintain the water levels during the low season, during the boating season, in order to maintain sufficient water for recreational boating and so on. And I would just call the court's attention to paragraph 32 of the ALJ's findings, which specifically recognizes that from 1987 through 2001, the diminished hydraulic capacity of the dam due to various things, including the way it was operated and maintained, caused lake levels to be higher than they would have been had all the gates been operated and the dam operated in compliance.
My understanding is your clients want to go back to those higher levels.
The purpose of the district's water level petition was to try to maintain that status quo that had prevailed,
right,
not just since 1987, as it says in that particular paragraph, but back to the 60s.
Even though it was higher than the actual levels that the DNR had set forth.
That's correct, Your Honor. The ALJ found that the gate froze shut in the late 60s. DNR was created that year.
I don't even see a red light anymore, Mr. O'Connor.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you for your argument, and I want to thank all the lawyers. That included Mr. Harrington, Ms. Hirsch, and Mr. Sweeney for their arguments in explaining to the court matters that are not necessarily within the experience of the court, either personal or as a result of prior cases, and this is not an easy factual case. So I want to really thank all of you for your briefs and for your oral argument. That concludes our argument in 08-AP-1523, Rock-Koshkonong Lake Districts versus DNR. And the court does not have further oral argument today. The court will meet in the conference room at 1:30 promptly.